Okay, thank you, David. I want to thank David and Jennifer for arranging this, inviting me. I feel like this is quite an honor to be giving a talk in a prestigious Institute of Physics. I did prepare on the way over here. I got a Richard Feynman CD on and listened to his words of wisdom, and it was very interesting. It was right on the money in terms of what your suggestions were, because to him, physics was all about having fun, and so this is going to be all about having fun. Let me start with something really dull so that we can put you to sleep right away and you won't have to wait a long time. If we think in terms of just a physical model of fire, this is a something in the fire science literature has been repeated over and over again, ad nauseum, which is supposed to tell us something about fire. You know, fire needs fuel, oxygen, and heat. If you're an ecologist or if you're somebody interested in the whole idea of pyrogeography, this will tell you absolutely nothing. And about a year ago or so, I started thinking about, in association with a book that William Bond and I are working on, how can we describe conceptually those things in the environment that are really critical to the generation of fire in different parts of the landscape. And it occurs to me there are really three important parameters that we need to focus on in terms of understanding pyrogeography, or as I described it here, ecosystem fire distribution. Certainly, primary productivity is going to be critical. If we're at the low end of productivity, say very arid deserts, simply not enough available fuels to drive fire. We can be, though, at the very high end of primary productivity and still not have fire in the landscape, because one of the really critical features of any environment with fire is seasonality. There's going to be an environment where at some time of the year all of that potential fuel is converted into available fuel due to a dry season that alternates with the wet season. And then, of course, ignitions. Now, about a year ago I was at this meeting in Australia with and I gave this graph to William, and I asked him what he thought of it. And I thought he was going to pat me on the back and say, what a bloody good job, John. Instead, he says, yeah. He says, you don't have anything about structure in here. We need to look at fuel structure. And he's absolutely right. If we're going to understand fire regimes, we have to add in one very critical component, not just the productivity, seasonality, ignition, but fuel structure, because fuel structure is what drives different fire regimes, and we really can't understand fire on the landscape unless we understand the regime. Just to give you a real-world example from California here of what we mean by fuel structure, if we take a typical landscape here in the coastal ranges just outside of Santa Barbara, we see a very different fuel structure on that landscape than if we go up into the Sierra Nevada, which is where I live. We see a completely different fuel structure. Associated with these differences in fuel structure are radical differences in the fire regime. These fuels are held near the ground, and they almost always will burn in high-intensity crown fires that will consume much of the above-ground biomass. In these forests, on the other hand, because they're much higher productivity environments, trees can outgrow the fuels, which are mostly here on the surface, and as a result, these commonly will not burn in high-intensity crown fires. Instead, we get low-intensity surface fire regimes. And so that's the critical role that fuel structure is going to play. It drives the fire regime. And it's these differences in regime which are really critical to understanding the role of fire on the landscape. Now, William talked a lot about what I tend to think of as fire as an ecosystem process. And in both of these systems, fire is really critical to the long-term sustainability of these ecosystems. These ecosystems have to have crown fire in order to persist. These are likely to not persist indefinitely without surface fire. Now, in the ecological literature, historically, ecologists and even biogeographers never really thought of fire as an ecosystem process. It was always described as a disturbance of some sort on the landscape. I tend to think in these fire-driven ecosystems where fire is a process, disturbance is the perturbation of that fire regime. So in this system here, the disturbance is not the fire. Disturbance is when you perturb that natural fire regime. Now, one of the things, and we'll hear more about this later, is these fire regimes are evident in the paleo record. And I won't go into this because I know Andrew Scott's going to have much better things to say about it. I'll just point out a couple things that have struck me. There are certain records, for example, this paper here by Kressler talks about these pre-gymnosperm forests with surface fire regimes. In many respects, it sounds a lot like the surface fire regime in a ponderosa pine forest. Other reports talk about these essentially crown fire regimes, where the evidence indicates with charred apices that these entire forests were taken out. So it suggests to me that this distinction between different regimes is something that's been set up for a long time. It's not a recent phenomenon on these landscapes. Now, one of the important things about differences in fire regime is how humans interact with those fire regimes. And this is a good illustration here of how humans in California have interacted with these two different fire regimes. This is something called a fire departure map. And basically what it tells you is what the landscape over the last 100 years has looked like in terms of fire frequency relative to what we think the historical conditions were. And this is the Angeles Forest, which is largely centered in Los Angeles County. This is San Bernardino County over here, and Ventura up there. These different colors indicate departures in different directions. All of these colors down here, the blues and purples, indicate those parts of the landscape that have missed fire cycles relative to what we think the historical condition was. And these are basically all the conifer forests at the high elevations. This would be here in the Angeles Forest, up in the Libre Mountains up there. All of the orange, yellow, orange, and red indicate departures in the opposite direction. Landscapes that have had much more fire than historically we believe would have been the case. In other words, a lot of the front side of the San Gabriel Mountains has had more fire than we think historically was the case. Some areas, like bordering the desert here, much more fire than we think historically was the case. And these represent, both of these conditions represent disturbances. They're departures from the fire regime on those landscapes. Now, I'm going to focus on this part of the landscape here, the lower elevation areas dominated by chaparral and dominated by crown fires, because these are the landscapes where in California we have had big fires. And we've had a number of, well, we have lots of fires that are significant size. And by big fires, I'm using that very generally, anything from 1,000 hectares to 100,000 hectares. It ranks up there as a big fire in a lot of different respects, but I'll talk more specifically about size in a minute. Now, let me just give you a history of fire in California, and this is what I call the short version of history. And that is, every decade we see a massive wildfire on our landscapes. Every decade we increase funding for fuel modifications, fire suppression activities. Every decade is followed by a decade of even worse fire impacts. And so it's clear that we don't really understand how to manage these landscapes in order to reduce the vulnerability of the communities to these big fire events. So that's what we're going to talk about now. And one of the reasons why we're particularly concerned about it is we're putting a huge amount of money into fire suppression efforts. This is a figure that shows the blue line here basically shows U.S. Forest Service expenditures for resource issues. The purple line basically shows expenditures for fire suppression. The Forest Service over the last 7 years has been spending as much or more money on fire issues than they have been for all the other resource issues that they're supposed to be dealing with. And one of the interesting things is most of this money is going to California, because California, these are different fires here in mostly in California, which indicate the costs from wildfires, and most of the expensive wildfires occur here in California. And that's a real concern to a lot of people, because here we have the Forest Service spending most of their money on fire issues, most of it going to California, and most of it going to fight fires at the wildland-urban interface, which means here we have a federal agency whose mandate is to protect natural resources, and most of the money is going to protect private property. It's a big issue in this part of the world, and probably one of the biggest or best suggestions of how to solve this problem is in a recent federal report. They talked about how the Forest Service ought to be talking to communities about getting reimbursed for fire suppression efforts. And I can't think of a better way to get communities to start thinking about how to solve these problems than to have them pay for them. Now, it's been suggested for a long time that contemporary wildfires on these landscapes are an artifact of past fire suppression activities, and this has allowed unnatural levels of fuels to accumulate. And this solution has been very appealing, and it's appealing, this suggestion is very appealing because it implies there's a solution that we can come up with to solve the problem. And the solution is we just change our fire management practices and we can solve our fire hazard problem, if indeed this is why we have big wildfires on the landscape. Now, I'll give you the end result here before we go through the evidence we have to support it. But the end result is, by and large, that's probably a valid model for a lot of forested landscapes. It's probably not a valid model for most of our lower elevation shrubland landscapes. Now, let me go back. I can't go back. I don't see arrows. Oh. Okay. This whole thinking in chaparral systems, I think, really got a kickstart back in the early 1980s by a paper that was really very influential at the time. This is a paper that Rich Minnick at UC Riverside published in Science, and it had a lot of impact at the time. And what it showed was if you looked at fire size north of the U.S.-Mexican border up here and compared it with fire size south of the border here, there were distinct differences in fire size. At least the dark shaded areas indicate fire size during this comparison period. And it was presumed that what was driving the difference between south of the border and north of the border was simply fire suppression activity, that we were putting out too many fires, causing fuels to accumulate, and that was what was causing our big fire problem. We can define this model, and I think it's important to look at this model and see to what extent it applies to these landscapes, but we can call this the fine-grained age patch model. The idea is that if we keep the landscape in a fine-grained patchwork of different aged vegetation, we can essentially prevent large fires. That's one of the major premises of the fine-grained age patch model. What it argues is that prior to fire suppression on these landscapes, we didn't have big fires. Big fires are an artifact of fire management activities. If you look at the historical record, though, there's lots of lines of evidence that suggest big fires on this landscape predated the introduction of fire suppression activities. And this is one illustration. This is a fire from the 19th century in the San Gabriel Mountains of Los Angeles County. You can clearly see this is a very large, high-intensity fire that burned a massive amount of this landscape. So it's clear that prior to fire suppression activities, we did have large fires. And in fact, we've reconstructed what is probably the largest fire in California history that occurred long before fire suppression activities. This was in 1889, and it occurred south of us here in Orange County, began at the northern end of the Santa Ana Mountains, and there's very good historical documentation from newspapers that show that fire burned almost the entire length of those mountains, and we've estimated that it's probably on the order of 100,000 or 125,000 hectares in size, and that would put it up there as one of the large or the largest fire that we have on record in the state. Now, another supposition in this fine grain age patch model that relates to the incidence of large fire is the notion that fire suppression policy has excluded most fires on this landscape, and this has resulted in anomalously large patches of old fuels. This has been approached from a variety of ways. Max Moritz, who's going to speak tomorrow, I guess, has done quite a bit to look at this whole model of how fuel age has changed on our landscapes. But one of the things that seems quite evident is throughout the certainly the first half of the 20th century, even though we had fire suppression policy, that policy had to do with landscapes that look like this. These were landscapes that were extremely difficult to apply fire suppression techniques to, and there's very little reason to believe that fire suppression has had much impact on those landscapes until probably later in the 20th century when we had the ability for aerial attacks as well as the ability to construct roads into these very mountainous regions. So even though we've had fire suppression on these landscapes for a very long period of time, it's doubtful it's had much impact. And this is illustrated by one of the fires during the early part of the 20th century. This is a fire that took place about 15 years after fire suppression policy was begun in Southern California. This was about a 90,000 acre, or what is that in hectares, in about 40,000 hectare fire that occurred in 1919. And it's been suggested by people who have been arguing this fine patch model that this was one of the first examples where fire suppression had altered the fuels on the landscape, and that was what was responsible for this massive fire. We've actually gone back through the fire suppression records and discovered that during the period prior to this 1919 fire, there was only a single natural lightning fire that was suppressed within that entire perimeter. And so there's very little evidence that fire suppression activity has played much role in terms of altering those fuel patterns. The same thing with a fire that hit a little closer to where we are today. We're here in Santa Barbara, which is just down the road here from Carpinteria. This is the 1932 Matilaha fire, and the Matilaha fire was up until about 30 years ago was the largest fire in California's history, or known at the time. Something on the order of about 90,000 hectares in size. If you go back through the prior 22 years of record of fire suppression activity, we find there was really only two lightning fires, one on the perimeter there and one there, that had been suppressed. So here the Forest Service had been applying fire suppression policy for 22 years, and during that time, in terms of lightning fires, they'd only ever suppressed two. There's very little reason to believe that this policy, even as late as 1932 here, had any impact in terms of altering natural fuel patterns in a way that might explain this big fire. In other words, what this suggests is fires like this are an endogenous part of this system. They aren't driven by past management activities. And this just gives you an illustration of what the landscape looked like in the area where the Matilaha fire burned. It was very rugged landscape, roadless landscape, and that's part of the reason why this fire became so big. It simply couldn't be touched in terms of most suppression activities. Now, let me talk about fire size in across the 20th century, or actually beginning from the late 19th century up to the 20th century, in terms of how has fire size changed over that time. This is plotting all of the fires that are in the California Fire History Database above 1,000 hectares in size. And the bottom line is there's no significant change in numbers of large fires over 1,000 hectares over this period of time. And even if we draw the line here at 10,000 hectares, still there's no significant change over this period of record in terms of numbers of very large fires. So To put it another way, we've had large fires throughout the 19th century, probably dating back through the Holocene on this landscape. And then going right up to the time of fire suppression activity, which began about 1906 here, we've had big fires throughout the period of record. So fire suppression policy simply hasn't been able to exclude fires on these landscapes, and we're still getting big fires. Now, one of the primary mechanisms that's always been proposed to why we might expect a patchwork of small fires might prevent large fires is this assumption that has been widely stated in the literature, and that is, on these landscapes, fires are fuel limited, and they won't carry in stands that are less than 20 years of age. And there's a lot of problems with this statement, because it turns out if you look at the historical basis of this, this whole notion was developed from studies of how to conduct prescribed burns. Well, prescribed burns on these landscapes are done under very low wind conditions, like less than 10 miles per hour, relatively modest humidity conditions. Under those conditions, this is probably true. However, we don't get wildfires under those conditions. We get wildfires under very different conditions. And if you look at young chaparral, this is a stand of chaparral that's 5 years since the last fire. There's nothing about that landscape that suggests it might be immune to burning, even under prescription conditions. Landscape is largely dominated by resprouting chamise shrubs here. And then these are all ephemeral things. In this case, this is something called deerweed. And it's a short-lived plant, maybe lives 5 or 6 years on most landscapes, dies back every spring, and leaves a huge amount of very fine flammable fuels. And these landscapes at 5 years of age are very flammable, readily can carry a fire. There's no reason to think if a fire got started in this, it's going to act as a barrier and prevent large fires. And we've actually seen examples in a number of cases. But you can model this too, using fire behavior models, and basically using this fuel model here that we've empirically determined, you can see that even at relatively modest wind speeds, in this case 20 kilometer per hour winds, you can still get a rate of spread through those stands. So there's no reason to think these young stands should in any way act as a barrier to fire spread. One of the interesting things, though, about flammability in these systems is I think that it hasn't been well worked out, but I actually think it's a lot more complicated than we used to think it is. Clearly, in these young stands, when you have this ephemeral post-fire flora coming up, they're capable of spreading fire. But what happens, say, after 5 or 10 years, this system here will recover, the evergreen shrubs close in, and when you get canopy closure, all of this ephemeral fuels, these surface fuels, die out and decompose, and you're left with a young stand of chaparral with very dominated by living foliage, which probably suppresses fire. And earlier, David talked about these flammability curves, and I noticed the flammability curve that I think best represents chaparral wasn't on there. And that's probably because we've never really collected the data. But this is the purpose of why we're here today is to make things up. So I made this curve up. This is my model of how I think flammability changes through time in these systems. I think right after fire, you get this ephemeral flora coming in, makes these systems very vulnerable to burning. But as the canopy closes in, the stand is dominated by living foliage, and that almost certainly suppresses fire for a period of year until we start getting dead wood accumulating in those stands, and then flammability goes up again. This is all fictitious. I just made it up, but I suspect it'll probably end up in a publication sometime. Okay. Chaparral is not a species. It's a vegetation type that's dominated by evergreen shrubs. And There's probably 15 or 20 different evergreen shrub species that are common throughout the range of chaparral. And generally, there's very little understory in the chaparral. It's mostly this overstory shrubland, very dense, almost impenetrable. In fact, as one author described it once, it was impossible to get through without extreme epidermal abrasion. So that'll describe mature chaparral. Chaparral burns at periodic intervals. Typically 30 to 120 years is what people suggest is probably the historical fire interval. And under those conditions, it does very well. It's very resilient to long fire-free periods. Once it burns, there's a very rapid regeneration from dormant seed banks, as well as resprouting from the base in many species. What's probably unique in North America about chaparral is right after fire, there's an ephemeral flora that comes up from dormant seed banks and dominated by annual species. And that ephemeral flora lasts for maybe 2 or 3 years. And often these species are closely tied to fire, and you simply don't see them except after fire. And many times they have been described as fire endemics or pyroendemics because you only see them after a fire. They're very hot fires. They're crown fires, and they generally are active crown fires, which means they burn from crown to crown. And yes, they are extremely hot fires. Now, one of the things that is probably the most convincing evidence that if you have young stands of vegetation, this is not going to act as a barrier to large fires. And we had proof of this in the most recent fires from 2007. These are these yellow shaded areas here. This is the Witch Fire, this is the Pumacha Fire, and the Harris Fire in 2007. What was really striking about those fires is they followed within 4 years of massive fires from 2003. And that's what these green outlines here represent. This is the Cedar Fire, one of the largest in state's history. And one of the things you'll notice is there's this huge overlap between the 2007 and the 2003 fires. And in fact, we estimate, I think in this figure here, we estimated something like, we've down-estimated those a little bit recently because we've learned that these overlap fire perimeters don't always represent reburning. But in general, we think that out of the all of the burning that took place in 2007 between San Diego and Ventura counties, that something like 500,000 acres burned and probably close to 80,000 acres was reburning of 2003 fires. In other words, these big fires were burning through areas that were only 4 years of age. So it tells us that stand age is not a big controller of the fire spread in these massive wildflower fires. Now, let me just add one last aspect to this fine-grained age patch model, and that is that one of the assumptions of the model is if all of these things were true, then it leads to this conclusion here that large fires are preventable. And this is something that I think a lot of us have come to conclusion, and CJ mentioned this earlier, have come to the conclusion that these large fires are probably not preventable. It's probably possible to reduce our vulnerability to them, probably not possible to prevent them on these particular landscapes. And to that end, let's talk about these big fires and try and understand what is it that drives the big fires. This is just a distribution of fires over 100,000 acres in California. And there's about a dozen of these fires that have been known historically. One of the interesting things about this pattern is there's clearly a biogeographical pattern, or maybe we should call this a pyrogeographical pattern. The whole central portion of the state seems to have been missed when it comes to these really large what the media has recently labeled megafires. We have a fair number of them in the southern part of the state, northern part of the state, but simply not in the central part of the state. And we'll talk a little bit more about this potential geographic pattern in a little bit. But let's just talk about Southern California for right now and try and understand what it is that's related to the distribution of these fires. These are all of the fires that have occurred in the southern part of the state from Santa Barbara south that have been more than 50,000 hectares or 120,000 acres in size. The largest, we believe, is this fire I talked about earlier, the 1889 Santiago Canyon fire, then followed by the Matilaha fire, and then the Laguna fire, etc. And talk about what are the potential causes of these big fires. Now, one of the obvious causes is weather. And in this part of the world, during the autumn, we get these weather events known as Santa Ana winds. It's a typhoon wind which develops when we have a high-pressure cell in the interior region and a low-pressure trough off the coast. We get very strong winds, easily 100 kilometer per hour winds, but often clocked in gusts at higher than that. And they often last for several days. All of these fires here are fires that were affected to some extent or another by Santa Ana winds. And what it tells us right away is, well, Santa Ana winds were involved in most of these. They certainly weren't involved in all of them. So you don't have to have Santa Ana winds to get one of these big mega fires. The other thing, though, to realize is Santa Ana winds occur every single autumn. We get at least 10 days of these winds on an annual basis, and yet over the time period from 1889 to 2007, we've only had 8 of these big megafires. So clearly, it's not just Santa Ana winds. There's something else that's likely driving this. And we think that one of the big factors that drives these huge fires are anomalously long droughts. And this is the same list of 8 fires here. Number of characteristics about those fires. But the thing I want to draw your attention to is these are months prior to the fire that had negative Palmer Drought Index. And the Palmer Drought Index, if it's negative, indicates it's a drought. And if it's positive, it indicates it's wetter than normal. This indicates that for every one of these fires, there was an anomalously long drought. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with our climate, we do get a drought every single year. Usually a 4 to 6 month drought from probably late spring to early fall. In all of the cases where we've had huge fires, we've had anywhere from 7-12 months of negative Palmer Drought Index to even much longer periods. And the 2003 fire, Cedar Fire, stands out as a real example of an extended drought. 54 of the prior 61 months to that fire had negative Palmer Drought Index. So what seems to be associated with all of these big megafires is an anomalously long drought period, much longer than the typical annual drought. Now, let's talk about these fires and try and understand how does drought affect the fires. And one of the ones we can talk about is the Zaca fire. Zaca fire is probably about the third largest fire in the state. And it's the fire we're going to visit this weekend on the field trip. So this is a preview to the field trip. Here's Carpinteria here, Santa Barbara. Where is Santa Barbara? Right about here. This fire was basically due north of where we are today. And this is the fire perimeter for the Zaca fire. Very elongated, and then it kind of spread out. It occurred just to the west of this fire I talked about earlier, the 1932 Matilaha fire. So this part of the world has had a number of really huge fires. And what were the causes of this Zaca fire? I think one of the... Well, that wasn't where I wanted to go. Well, let me just give you a little background of this Zaca fire. The Zaca fire is one of our eight biggest fires in the state. It's one of the two of those big fires that did not occur during Santa Ana wind conditions. This was a summer fire. Occurred in July. In fact, it occurred in July and August. It was a 60-day fire event. And so clearly the high winds of the Santa Ana conditions had nothing to do with this particular fire. So what are the causes of the Zaca fire? The Zaca fire occurred this past July and August, and those months were more or less in the middle of a very severe drought, probably one of our most severe droughts that we have, certainly in contemporary records. And so the fact that it occurred during severe droughts is certainly one of the reasons for the size of this fire. Is that an indication that I should be done? Yeah, that's fine. Any questions? Sure.
Why then?
I'm not going to address that. No, I'll address it. Why do we not get large fires south of the border? First off, I don't think that we necessarily know that we don't get large fires. And I have a paper now that's coming out, it's in press now. And in there is a description of a massive Santa Ana wind-driven fire in Baja from the late 1700s by the English explorer Vancouver, who was off the coast of Ensenada, and he described this three-day fire event was massive. So we do know historically there have been massive fires. I think there, when I think about differences between Baja California north of the border, the supposition that fire suppression policy is what explains it, in my mind, is a hypothesis. There are other hypotheses that have never been explored. For example, the intensive rural land use south of the border is very different north of the border. You go down into San Diego County and there's these massive ranches and basically relatively few people living on large ranches, mostly commuting to the city. You just go across the border and it's a totally different economy. It's small ejidos with people who graze goats and are working the land very, very intensively. And as a result, intensive land use is certainly part of the reason that landscape is fragmented and you don't have the large contiguous fuels that you have north of the border. And it's potentially as much due to... Oh. Yep. Here.
John, the nub of the problem is that, and this is for those people who don't know, it's the same argument in Australia, and the dominant fire managers are saying that it is their duty bound to undertake hazard reduction burning, and there's a lot of resources, particularly after the number of mega fires which have occurred in near Canberra and Sydney and Melbourne. But the argument in their defence is that even if climate-driven fires are inevitable, they may be reducing, there may be some effect on reducing the risk of those climate-driven fires. In other words, an intensive intervention may lower the risk of a set of fires becoming uncontrollable, providing more of a window for suppression. That's where everybody gets into a very difficult not philosophy anymore, it's actually about who's willing to wear the moral danger associated with a non-intervention strategy versus an intervention strategy, because after all, people are more important than health.
I agree with everything you say. Let me just way though. In our part of the world, we have a lot of different management approaches that are used to modify fuels. And there are basically two reasons why you might want to modify natural fuels. One is to do like the age patch model says, and that is create a mosaic landscape that will act as a barrier. I think we know pretty clearly under a lot of conditions those treatments are not going to act as a barrier. There's a whole other reason, though, for doing fuel treatments. And one of those reasons is to provide defensible space for firefighting activities. And there's no question that fuel treatments have lots of potential in that regard. The big question is, strategically, where does it make the most sense to do it? We know that at the wildland-urban interface around people's homes, it makes immense sense to do fuel treatments. The real unknown is, once you get away from the wildland-urban interface, are they cost-effective? Is it strategic to put a 1,000-foot fuel break into the Los Padres Forest, like you can see if you just drive up the mountain here? We actually don't know the answer to that question because it hasn't been studied. And it's actually quite amazing to me. The Forest Service has been doing treatments like this for 70-some years, and they have had a research unit for at least that long, and they've never addressed the question, is it cost-effective? And if it is, where is it most cost-effective to do that treatment? And so to me, that's the big question. Where does it make sense to do treatments? And it's actually the focus of a research program we have going right now. We have just finished putting together a GIS database of all the fuel treatments on all the forests from Los Padres South. And then we're going to look at fire histories and ask the question, where did those fuel treatments make a difference, and to what extent did they make a difference? But it's not that simple, though, because, you know, it's the trade-off between fire risk and fire hazard. And fire scientists often distinguish risk and hazard. It's not uniformly done in other disciplines, but in fire science, risk is normally thought of as the probability of getting a fire, hazard being how bad that fire is going to be. Now, goats are pretty good at reducing hazard, but they're probably very good at increasing risk because they actually stimulate production of alien grasses, which are really the flammable fuels that persist for a long period of time. So it's really not simple when it comes to how to deal with these issues. I have no idea what I was going to say about this. Okay, this is the Zaca fire. This is where we're going to go this weekend. And one of the things that I was going to point out about the Zaca fire is if you talk to fire managers, they'll tell you this was not a wind-driven fire like we're used to in Southern California. It was a fuel-driven fire, and they call it a fuel-driven fire because the fuels during, in fact, is it dangerous if I try and go back? No. Cute little mouse. Okay. There's two reasons why the Zaca fire was called a fuel-driven fire. The Zaca fire burned in July and August of 2007. And it was a severe drought, and this is what the fuel moistures look like during that period of time relative to the long-term average for different times of the year. In other words, there was a huge deficit relative to what normally you see in the summer. So fuels were much drier during July and August of 2007 than they were had been historically. And so that's one of the aspects to why this was affected heavily by fuels. But the other thing is, this is a very isolated, remote area, and the fuels in that landscape had not been subjected to this excess of fires that we see over much of our landscape because it's so isolated. And as a result, if you look at this is the perimeter of the Zaca fire here, this black outline, And you can see huge portions of this fire dated back. The last fire was on the order of 70 years ago or more. So in other words, these were fairly old fuels. So not only were they drier than normal, they're probably the fuel load was higher than normal. And that's thought to be some of the primary reasons why this area burned, this fire was so large. The other aspect, though, is this is extremely rugged topography, and I've heard some fire people describe this as a topography-driven fire, because what topography does is it sort of takes the place of wind. Wind basically pushes the flaming front parallel to the ground, and it keeps that flaming front close to the fuels ahead of it, heats them, and causes them to combust more easily. Terrain can do the same thing. When the fire's burning up a steep slope, the flaming front stays close to the foliage and can heat it and stimulate combustion. So there's a number of things that were going on in the Zaca. Very dry year, very isolated area. As a result, the fuels were older than typically we see on these landscapes, probably heavier fuel loads. And then in addition, the very rugged terrain probably took the place of wind in many instances. Plus, the rugged terrain prevented direct fire action on these fires. In other words, much of this area had no roads, so everything had to be done by air or by packing firefighters into the landscape. Now, there's a lot of questions that we have about why this fire became so big. Some people contend that the ages of the vegetation on this landscape played a big role in containing it. For example, it's pointed out that this perimeter here was very young fuels, on the order of about 10 years of age, and I've seen reports where incident commanders have suggested the fire was stopped because of those young fuels. We see the same thing over here. This end of the perimeter, we see young fuels suggest that the fire burned into young fuels, and then here's one of those instances where maybe young fuels played a role. Now, the one thing I have to caution you is that it is really dangerous to take a static fire perimeter map like this with stand ages and draw conclusions. Because whenever you see a perimeter here of where the fire stopped, there's really three possible explanations for it. One could be it ran out of fuel because it hit a young fuel age class. The other could be that that's where firefighters chose to take a stand to light backfires. And in fact, that's actually what happened all along that perimeter, because if you're an incident commander and you have to send somebody out to light a backfire, you're not going to send them to these old fuels here. You're going to send them to young fuels. And the other thing is wind often shifts in very erratic ways, and it could be that fires stop at a perimeter just because of a shift in the wind. So the point is that if you look at a static map like this, you got to be careful in how you interpret it. It could be lots of different things. And in fact, one of the things that suggests to me that probably this perimeter is not highly controlled by the fuels is if you look at this perimeter all around the fire here, and you calculate the age classes of where the fire stopped, we calculate that only about 27% of that perimeter abuts young age classes. And in fact, 40% of that perimeter abuts very old age classes. So it's clear that it's very complicated when you look at a map like this trying to draw conclusions. Now, let's talk about a fire that was a very different one than the Zaca fire. Here's the Zaca fire, took place in July. Let's talk about the Witch fire here. Now, the Witch fire was also preceded by a very long, anomalously long drought. It occurred during October, and we think that probably the drought had very little impact on live fuel moisture in a way that might affect the size of that fire. If you go back to this fuel moisture figure here, this is 2007, very low fuel moistures during the Zaca fire. Here we get to the Witch fire in October, and what do we see? We see that even during this very severe drought, by the time October rolls around, fuel moistures really aren't much different than they are from the long-term average, and that's because every year, except in anomalous ones where we have wet springs, every year we typically have very dry live fuel moistures in the autumn. And so these autumn fires are probably not affected. The big ones are probably not affected by unusual live fuel moisture. What we think is probably going on is these very long periods of drought are affecting the survivorship of entire plants as well as terminal branches and leaves. In other words, what we think is driving these really big fires is these very long droughts that increase the amount of dead fuel in the landscape. And in 2007, this was very evident throughout Southern California. We had lots of instances where you could see dieback just at the tips of plants. You could see entire shrub, or here you see the same thing. This is on a big cone Douglas fir tree, lots of dieback and terminal branches. This was quite common in many parts of Southern California in 2007. Entire shrubs died back. We had landscapes where there was just much greater than usual amount of dead wood on that landscape. And we think this dieback is probably one of the big features that drives large fires. And primarily, the way we think that this dieback affects big fires is through ember production. One of the things that's distinctly different between live fuels and dead fuels is if you take a live fuel and dry it down to the lowest level that you can get it to without killing it, generally it's still too moist for an ember to ignite in that live fuel. In other words, you have to have dead fuels to get an ember to ignite. And this is just some modeling studies here that look at firebrand ignitions versus amount of dead fuel moisture. Levels like 5 to 7% dead fuel moisture, not uncommon during the fall in our part of the world, and you can get almost 100% ignitions of embers under those dead fuel moistures. And the more dead fuel you have in the landscape, this is 15 tons per hectare versus 2.5, the greater the distance that those embers are likely to travel. And we think that that's probably the primary mechanism by which very long and extended droughts affect these massive fires, is they just increase the amount of dead tissue and fuel on the landscape, and that increases the probability of embers spreading during these fires. And that's important because even under Santa Ana wind conditions, when you have a wind blowing 60 kilometers per hour, the fire front is never moving anywhere close to that fast. However, once the embers get above the fire front, the embers can move 60 kilometers per hour. And I've heard fire managers and incident commanders tell me that in big fires, they think that's probably one of the big drivers behind the size of the fire, is just the success of spotting on the landscape. And that's going to be driven by the amount of dead fuels. Now, lastly, we ought to look at this pattern here, because this is something that ought to be of a bit of concern. Out of the 8 large megafires, that's kind of redundant, the 8 large fires on our landscape, most of these have occurred in about the last 35 years. And in fact, half of them have occurred just within the last 5 years. And that's a matter of some concern, particularly in this day and age when we're concerned about climate change and the fact that things may be changing on our landscape. And it's probably not an artifact that we've had a rash of these big fires if, in fact, extended drought is part of the explanation. This is the Palmer Drought Index, averaged by decades since 1895. And basically, we see that there's been a decline throughout the 20th century in the Palmer Drought Index in Southern California. And in fact, the last 40 years have been a continuous drought on these landscapes, at least on average. The large error bars here indicate that there were wet years. But on average, we've had a lot of drought. And it is the amount of drought that's going to affect the amount of dead wood on the landscape. Even if you have a high rainfall year, the dead wood is still represents a legacy on the landscape that potentially could drive big fires later on. The big question in terms of anthropogenic impacts is, are we looking at a trajectory here where continued climate change is going to cause an extended drought, or is this just cyclical? And there's certainly every reason to believe that there could be a cyclical component. Yeah. I'm going to mention that in just a minute. Why don't you see if I don't answer that, and if not, you can ask that again. This is some paleo data on Palmer Drought Index, which illustrates at least the potential that what we're looking at is a cyclical phenomenon that we potentially could recover from. This is Palmer Drought Index just for the summer based on tree ring data. And certainly if you just go back to the 1840s, 1850s, 60s, we had a long period of very extended droughts, not substantially unlike what we're seeing right now. And if you go back even further in time, we've had very extended droughts in the past. So there's certainly some reason to believe that this is a cyclical phenomenon, may not be anthropogenic. And then the other side of this is that they're not mutually exclusive ideas. This could be part of a cyclical phenomenon, but if anthropogenic climate change is causing changes in the severity of the drought, maybe the upturn might not be as much of a recovery as you might have gotten in the absence of anthropogenic climate change. Now, the last thing I just want to mention is this point about populations. In California, we're seeing models that project maybe a 2 to 3 degree increase in temperature over the next maybe 40 years. What's real concern to me is our fire issues are ones that occur at the wildland-urban interface, and we're looking over the next 40 years, probably a 50% increase in our population. And the big question is what scares you more? Is it the 2 degree change in the temperature, or is it this 50% increase in population? Because this means we're going to be putting many more people at risk by the expansion of that wildland-urban interface. And so there's really more than just one global change that we need to be concerned about. It's not just the climate change, but it's also the human change. Now, lastly, let me just mention something about the role of geography in these big fires. One of the things we notice when we look at megafires in Southern California is they've only occurred, the big ones, bigger than, say, 50,000 hectares, they've only occurred down here in San Diego County and up here in Ventura, Santa Barbara County. These counties here, Los Angeles, Orange, Riverside, San Bernardino, we've had big fires, but nothing close to these big megafires. The Santa Monica Mountains here, they've had lots of big fires, but the biggest fire they ever had was only 14,000 hectares. I think there's topographic reasons for this. In this part of the world, Santa Ana winds drive all of their big fires, and the winds blow north from the north through canyons. This part of the landscape is basically a barrier to fires because it's an urban area, and then of course the Pacific Ocean here is a barrier. And so I think there's topographic reasons why you don't get a 50,000 hectare fire in that part of the world, and I think similar arguments here in some of these other counties. Whereas up in Santa Barbara, Ventura County, you have probably the largest extensions of chaparral vegetation of anywhere in the state. In fact, not probably, you do. The largest expanses are in that part of the world. So geography plays a role in where you get these massive fires. And then lastly, demographic changes have a big effect. For example, in San Diego County, it was only in the last 5 years or 35 years that we started getting really big Santa Ana wind-driven fires. I think part of that has to do with changes in demography. San Diego developed along the coast, and this was where everybody wanted to live. But in the last part of the 20th century, there's been greater and greater expansion of development into the interior. Now, if you have winds, in this case, here they blow from east to west. If you have winds blowing in this direction and you start a fire here, because most all our fires are started by people, you're going to have a relatively small fire. As that population moves eastward, you have a greater potential of starting a fire in a place where you're likely to get a much larger Santa Ana wind-driven fire. So I think there are a lot of things that go into this equation, and certainly different demographic patterns as well as topography are all part of the picture. So I end it there. Thank you. Happy to answer any more questions unless everything's been answered. I'll hold all my questions.
Thank you.
Sure.